No.
No? Okay.
No, it's the guardianship is granted, and or if somebody files a petition to dissolve it, then that is usually set for an evidentiary hearing.
Okay.
If it's
So then
again,
once,
like
yeah.
Judge Dollinger said, if somebody's not consenting, then the guardianship becomes a contested evidentiary hearing, and of course it should be in person because then there's testimony.
Okay. So Jamie, let's create a row on under juvenile dependency, under just below reviews permanency. We'll just create a separate row that is case closure hearings and
Okay.
presumptively virtual.
Got it.
All right. Anybody else have anything on the family side?
I still do. I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead, Audrey.
Okay. Adjudicatory and plea hearings should be separate. Plea hearings for most of the dependency judges, they're allowing the parents and the attorneys to appear virtually to
Okay.
enter their plea. I understand why an adjudicatory should be in person because it's a trial.
Okay.
There's again, my judge, I'm just going to say my judge, requires parents to be there in person for plea hearings. She also requires attorneys to be there in person for plea hearings if we don't know how our client is going to plead. That is a complete waste of time, and let me tell you why.
Okay.
The DA does not have the time to get up and walk out of court during 12 plea hearings and negotiate a petition with me and my client if this is the first time I'm meeting my client.
Okay.
They're not going to do it. We've told the judge they're not going to do it. So to make us go down there in person when the burden is on the client to reach out to us and they have not, when we can't negotiate the plea, is a waste of time. A lot of these parents, same thing, transportation issues. If the department told them, look, if you can't get Wi-Fi, if you can't turn on a camera, then you need to be in person, fine. I agree with that because they are being canvassed after we enter their plea and the judge should be able to see them. But I do believe they should be presumptively virtual.
Okay. Paige, anything to add on that?
Just that I think it could, some of it is kind of the semantics, like when it says adjudicatory slash plea on our table. We call them adjudicatory hearings. Sometimes they're called hearings on the petition. And if the parents deny the allegations in the petition and we're setting it for an evidentiary hearing, then it's an evidentiary hearing in person. But what Ms. Beeson described in terms of if they decide to admit or submit basically a no contest answer to the petition, then those are virtual with me, presumptive virtual, and I canvass them virtually as long as they have their video capability. And I mean, it's a hearing that usually takes 5 minutes. And then the dispositional hearing is set 2 weeks afterwards. So the adjudicatory hearings, if they're not contested, are a very short hearing type.
So is the adjudicatory hearing occurring at the same time after a plea in some
So
instances?
we don't call them plea hearings. It's
Okay.
an a, the adjudicatory hearing is akin to just that first hearing on the petition where the parent is answering, providing an
Okay.
answer to the petition, which I think is where we get plea from, maybe.
Okay.
So I just think the way it's written here, maybe we want to differentiate if it's a contested adjudicatory hearing versus uncontested. I don't know.
Well, I'm just trying to understand the process. So, if somebody comes in and they're admitting to a petition, and it's going to roll right into an adjudicatory hearing,
No, that is the adjudicatory hearing.
that is the adjudicatory
That
hearing.
is the adjudicatory
So,
hearing.
if somebody comes in and says, I'm going to contest the petition, then the adjudicatory hearing is occurring at a later time?
Right, and it turns
Okay.
into a trial. Like we're
Okay.
having a trial on the petition.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, All right. So it
sounds. And then those are in person.
We do need to divide this somehow so that it's not confusing as to what's occurring. So presumptively virtual for.
I mean, we call them initial plea hearings. Okay. We could call them initial petition plea hearings.
Something. Yeah, that's where I think there's a difference just in the language that can get confusing because I think different jurisdictions probably call it a different thing.
Same thing everywhere.
Yeah, right.
And that's easy enough.
Admit, deny hearings.
Yeah.
And usually we set the date for the adjudicatory and then the admit, deny is usually about a week before the adjudicatory. And so then that way, if they come to the admit, deny and deny, then everybody knows that they're going forward with the adjudicatory in a few days. And that's in person.
Is there a way, this is Patty, is there a way to just describe that in words as opposed to giving it a label, since the labels vary throughout the jurisdictions? If you can, you know, just explain what it is and say that those are virtual, you know, presumptively virtual. So whatever you call it, you know, we have this kind of common definition.
Maybe we should refer to the statute in 432B. Like,
oh, that's a good idea. Yeah.
And sorry off the top of my head, but yeah, because what Judge Hill is describing, we do it differently in the second where someone comes in and either admits or denies. If they deny, then we're setting all those future dates at that initial admit deny hearing. We don't already have a trial date set.
So why don't we call it admit deny hearing, presumptively virtual, and then contested adjudicatory hearings, presumptively in person.
Well, I would throw in no contest with admit deny so people don't freak out.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, nobody in the second would know. Everyone would be, the practitioners would be confused by that. Yeah. But I think we can figure it out.
Would everybody understands what a contested adjudicatory hearing would be?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we just need to figure out 432B 470 hearing or whatever the statute is that pertains to admit, deny, no contest response to the petition. So let's divide that one up as well, Jamie. We'll have contested adjudicatory hearings, presumptively in person, uncontested adjudicatory hearing, and I realize that may subsume in some jurisdictions a admit hearing, but uncontested adjudicatory hearings, presumptively virtual. And then if somebody can get us the statute for what we would call the admit deny hearing.
I will.
Okay. Thank
you. I'll email Jamie.
Okay.
Thank you.
Then we'll have that as that'll be a third row, and that'll be presumptively virtual.
Okay.
Okay, what do you got next, Audrey?
My question would be the adoptions, the presumptively in person.
I thought we had, this is Patty, I thought we had reverted to discretion of the court on that one. There was some discussion at the last meeting about, you know, kind of the pros and cons of having those in person versus virtual. And so ultimately, I think the consensus was to just leave that to judicial discretion. I mean, there may be some reasons why a judge may want to have the adoption in person. I don't know what those reasons would be. Maybe just to see how the kid interacts with the adoptive parents. I'm not sure. But then there are also cost concerns and, you know, resources to take time off of work, to have to come down. I mean, most of the time, those are very celebratory proceedings. I mean, the ones I've seen are very celebratory and people like being there in person. But again, I don't think the subcommittee had a strong preference one way or the other.
And I would just say that for the adoptions, I think it's okay to say presumptive in person, but I think that a judge should be deferring to the family. And so I would say at this point, I have more families asking for a virtual hearing for the adoption than I do in person. Whatever they want to do is what we do. If they want to have it in person and have that more formal celebratory proceeding in the courtroom, then totally. But if they just want to be virtual so that they can go to the water park after the hearing or go to lunch with their family, then I just defer to them. But
so wouldn't it, would
there's
it
an off-ramp there.
For that to be presumptively virtual, and if people actually want to come to court and have their day in court, so to speak, or that experience, they could, you know, say, hey, I want to show up in court. I want to be there with the judge and take pictures and do whatever.
That's what I think is easier, because the judge can just say, but if you want to come in person, and there are families that do, they want to come in person, they want to take a picture with the judge, etc. Fantastic. Right. But then it's based on the adoptive parents, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Instead of the judge.
Yeah, it sounds like on this one, we really are kind of, we play a very minimal role as the judge. So this is more about accommodating the parents and the kids that are kind of receiving the gift of the adoption. And it would seem that if we go presumptively virtual, they're understanding, hey, you can show up if you want, for sure. Okay. All right, let's move that one over then as well. All right, what else, Audrey?
That's it.
Yay, okay. Just kidding, thank you. All right, let's move back to the preamble, because there were, I needed to get back to the legal aid language, the pro bono language, and I had another thing that I wanted to talk about. And I think, Jamie, I'm guessing we may have lost our quorum by now, right?
We are just at it. If we lose one more member, we're
I don't know. We're not really going to vote on any of this today or not. But so the quick thing, and we can talk about this whenever we set our next meeting, but the quick thing is the Supreme Court rule that I referenced earlier about appearing by simultaneous audio visual transmission means says when you want to deviate from that, you have to notify the court 5 days in advance. What we've proposed in our rules is notifying the court 48 hours in advance. I'm okay with the 48 hours thing, but I think that's going to conflict with what the Supreme Court rule is right now. So Ron and I asked him about it earlier because he's much more experienced with amending rules than I am. He seems to think that it would be fairly easy to amend the Supreme Court rule, but I don't think we can push something out right now before that Supreme Court rule is amended, that's in conflict with it. So we either need to change to 5 days or somehow get the Supreme Court rule changed before we push this thing out.
Can we just say consistent with the Supreme Court rule?
In terms of notifying the court?
Yeah, so that way if we do get the rule changed, it'll just automatically adapt to the change in the rule, because we'll just say in conformity with Supreme Court rule, whatever it is.
Well, yes and no. Yes, I would say, because that's very much a consistent and easy way to do it. But we're also, there's probably things that we're allowing for in here that don't fall under that Supreme Court rule, right? Remember, the Supreme Court rule lists those 4 or 5 categories of what is presumptively supposed to be in person. And we've got other things in here that the notice to the court would apply to. So I think probably we just need to maybe have a 48 hours prior to the appearance, unless otherwise, you know what I'm getting at, right? It's late. Unless otherwise dictated by Supreme Court rule. Like, we can provide a time frame and say that this is the time frame unless Supreme Court rules provide otherwise.
Justice Sherman, this is Judge Clark Navery. In looking at the Supreme Court rules, there's probably a couple of areas that need revision. Of course, that would come from you all in order for it to be congruent to what we are all proposing in these virtual advocacy rules. So the 5 court days, but also the manner or the mechanism of which notice would not necessarily be required because of the presumption. So I think a lot of that, I think you're right. I think the Supreme Court rule has to be amended before the virtual advocacy rules would be effective.
Doug, and let me suggest this.
Yeah.
I think we can we can turn that around in no time. I don't think it needs a public hearing to change a Supreme Court rule.
Okay.
What I would suggest is we throw this to Phaedra. We get everything finalized in our rule and our preamble. And then we'll throw it to Phaedra to do a run against the Supreme Court rules. And then we'll throw it on a conference and we can change that. And
okay.
Nothing flat.
Okay. All right, I'll ask Lydia to put it back on a conference and we could reach out to Phaedra. That would be terrific because I agree with what Tara said. Look, there are some other areas, and a lot of the Supreme Court rule kind of was promulgated by the old telephonic transmission appearances. And the criminal side of it only provides for witnesses to appear by audiovisual. So it doesn't, what we're doing isn't really going to have any impact on the criminal side of things, but civil family, it would. So yeah, that would be terrific if we can get them. Okay. And then Patty, on the part in the preamble where you and Jonathan came up with the language about where there are cases involving representation by a pro bono attorney, the court shall defer to the preference of the pro bono attorney, except that evidentiary hearings and trials shall be presumptively in person. I don't think we can do that broadly, where we tell
them okay.
They have to defer to the attorneys on things, right? I mean, I get, like, when we were first talking about it, whether it's pro bono or any other type of appointed counsel, if you're being asked to take a case, or I should probably reword that, when you're willing to take a case and help out in another, you know, county, then we obviously want to make sure that there's going to be some accommodations there. But I don't think we can say, hey, everybody else in the bar that lives in Washoe County has to abide by this, but pro bono attorneys in Washoe County, for instance, get to tell the court what they want to do, right?
Okay.
Does that make sense? Am I explaining that right?
That does. This is Jonathan and Justice Herndon. I can say, you know, it's going through the list of presumptions. Like when we were looking at that, we didn't have that list yet.
Okay.
And I went through it with the pro bono director at Legal Aid Center, and he thought it looked really good and created a lot of opportunities for, you know, our pro bonos, for us to recruit pro bonos for more rural areas. I will say the one thing he said is a lot of pro bonos will ask him when he's trying to place a case, can I appear remotely? And so there's not that, you know, there's nothing, if he says, I don't know, you have to ask the court, they just say they won't take the case. And I think maybe these presumptions, and if the courts that are going to deviate are clear on what they're doing, like I think we talked earlier about classes of cases because of the unique circumstances with a court where that class is going to be not remote, for example, in person, I think we'd be able to let them know up front, you know, what they're getting into. And then the courts that don't allow virtual are just, I think the reality is it'll create access to justice issues for those case types.
So let me ask you this, Jonathan, because this was an idea that I had. In the preamble right above where you all were proposing that language, it says, if a case type is presumptively in person, it is expected that all necessary parties will appear in person unless good cause is shown to justify a virtual appearance. What if we added onto that something that said, court should give deference to pro bono and or appointed counsel appearing in cases outside the counties in which they reside?
I think that would be helpful. It would be, I mean, we're always going to have a couple sticklers, right? You know, yeah. Judges who just don't get it. And I think, you know, that's where we'll run into trouble. But I do think anything we can add in there that provides strong guidance, I think is good.
Doug,
I think that addresses the problem, right? Because pro bono attorneys may want to take a case in a county that is far away, and they would be incentivized to do so if they could appear remotely. I think that the presumptions that exist, like Jonathan said, would be fine, but I like the addition of the language that you just proposed to ensure that, you know, we are giving due consideration for people who are willing to go outside of their jurisdiction to help others in our state who do not otherwise have access to justice. to be able to appear remotely when you know you know they don't want to fly to you know Elko for a 10-minute hearing just because it's presumptively in person. So I like that. I would endorse that.
Yeah, and look, it's not. I mean, I was trying to think of it more broadly. It's not just pro bono. For instance, Marcy's folks that are appointed to cases have this same issue with sometimes you're being asked to be pulled in 15 different directions. And if we're kind of putting some language in there that tells the courts, wink, wink, this is good cause. So you need to give deference to virtual appearance requests from pro bono or appointed counsel in cases which they're appearing in jurisdictions outside the jurisdictions in which they reside. If we come up with some type of language in that regard, I think it would be very helpful.
Is there also a way to address attorneys that are appearing in different departments, just like if we were down there physically and we check in or we let the department know ahead of time that they don't call our case without us?
I think that's outside of the scope of the virtual or in person.
Right? That's been going on since, you know, before the internet was invented, right? Where you get to court at 8:35 and the judge, you know, started the 8:30 calendar at 8:20 and already dealt with your case, right? Too bad. That is a, it's not just a horrible inconvenience. It's a horrible way to do business. I get it.
I think Perry that most
Gary,
of the
Perry Gary used to do that all the time as a district court judge.
No, Perry Gary would gladly trail your case while you went to go do your other case. And then he would, I think most of the judges in the eighth do that anyway. They trail, if you let them know ahead of time, they'll trail your case and wait for you. So
most of them do. It's just my concern that when you properly notified everybody, I have no control over how fast one judge does their calendar. So, you know what I'm saying? And if I've notified every single judge that I've got hearings in three different courtrooms at the same time, and then I, you know, sign on and my hearing's done and it went forward without me, but my client was there, that's an issue.
So there's another subcommittee of the JCSN that we've started about the family courts and how to improve the family courts. If you don't mind, I would love to reach out to you on that issue, because that might be something that we can handle within that subcommittee. But I'm not sure that it fits within the purview of the virtual and, you know, presumptively in person versus virtual. But that is really something that we should address. And I'm happy to reach out to you, or you can reach out to me. I'm sorry, I don't know who I'm talking to because I'm driving. If you could reach out to me, I'd be happy to add your voice to that, the larger commission on the improvement of the family courts.
Yeah, absolutely. I will. Thanks.
Okay. So we got a lot to think about, a lot of little language tweaks to make, but I think we got a lot accomplished today. So I appreciate everybody.
Doug, were you okay with the rest of the pro bono language in there? I just want to make sure we close the loop on that.
What I wrote down was adding a sentence that said, courts should give deference to virtual appearance requests by pro bono and or appointed counsel appearing in cases outside the counties in which they reside, except that evidentiary hearings and trials shall be presumptively in person.
That's great for me. Okay. So if there were no other comment, because we had some other additions, but if you're okay with those.
I didn't see the copy I've got only had that.
That's all I have.
That's all I had.
Jonathan, do you have the other changes? I think I thought I said there were some other changes in there.
Yeah, one dealt with the openness of the courts, which I think Justice Herndon dealt with earlier in the meeting relative to like posting of links on websites. So that website. I went through and I think that, and then I think that covered it. The appendixes with the presumptions.
Okay.
All right. That sounds good to me. Sorry.
No worries. Good. All right. So let's do this. Let's go ahead and close our meeting today. We've been going for a very long time, 2.5 hours. I appreciate everybody that has stayed strong and remained online with us. We will have Jamie, I'm sure, be reaching out soon to set up another meeting, so we can tweak this a little further and get it in front of everybody. And hopefully, like I said, get it to vote and get through all this by October. We'll also kind of keep you updated on trying to see if we can make some changes to the Supreme Court rules that allow us to do this without being in conflict with that at all. Before we all jump off, was there anything that anybody else wanted to say or add or throw out there for future consideration? No, thank you. Okay. All right. Then we will close it up. I appreciate it. Everybody have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Jamie, thank you very much. If you need any like language from any of these notes or whatever, I know you're really good about writing all that down. Just let me know.
Okay. I will follow up. I'll get a draft circulated probably by the end of next week.
Okay. Perfect.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.